Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. It is May 5th, 2020, the 11th day of the year, 5780, still in our COVID-19 world. Israel pulling out of it to a great extent, people out and about, reopening schools, even the gym. Oh, my goodness, I might actually get to this pool in the next couple of weeks, but there's definitely a sense, hopefully, God willing, that the worst is behind us. The numbers are falling, and definitely a sense of optimism here in the air. So I am on the line today with someone who you know very, very well, Gil Hoffman, who, of course, you know as Land of Israel Network podcaster, now on hiatus. But his day job when he's not with us is chief political correspondent and analyst at the Jerusalem Post. But more importantly than that, a good friend. So hi, Gil. Good morning.
Good morning, Eve. Pleasure being with you on Rejuvenation. I love your show.
Well, thank you. So some of you might be wondering why I asked Gil on. It is different to be interviewed than to be the interviewee. And Gil and I have been in virtual touch, of course, a lot over the last few weeks as he's gone through a very difficult time in his life. And I thought that a lot of you could relate to what's been going on with Gil, and I felt that it was worth dragging him out of his, not semi-retirement, but out of his hiatus in order to share with us a little bit of his thoughts and what's been happening. You guys can't see him, but he has, he's normally clean-shaven, he's got a beard, because of the mourning period that the Omer that we're in right now, where religious men generally don't shave, but also because he is in personal mourning. So Gil, what has been happening with you in the last few weeks since our listeners last heard from you?
Well, when I last had a show, in which is going to cock hopefully, I went to America to visit my mother. For the second time this year, with the encouragement of me, because I knew that she did not have much time left. My mother's been fighting breast cancer on and off for 12 years, and the cancer had already spread to her brain. And I came in January, she was still in very good spirits and everything and fighting. And when I came back in March, immediately after our election here, she was no longer interested in fighting. And it was very clear that this would be the last visit. And so while there were those who told me not to get on that plane, and so shortly after I arrived in the United States, the Israeli government did decide to require a two-week quarantine period upon our return to Israel from anywhere in the world, I'm still very glad that I went and spent time with her, because on the second day of Passover, she passed.
I know that with everything that's going on here in the world, and you're talking about going to Chicago, of course, which is your hometown, there are many people who haven't had a chance to say goodbye because of the travel restrictions, because of sometimes even when people are in the same town as somebody else, if someone's dying, you know, of the COVID, then they can't go in because of fear that they themselves will get sick. So you left your mom knowing that it was goodbye, knowing also that you were going to come back to Israel and sit for 2 weeks in quarantine. But that was a decision that you made in order to do that. When you left, did your mom also know it was goodbye? I mean, she was aware of the situation she was in.
So, I think so. When you stop taking some of your medicine, you're making a decision. Mm-hmm. But she did ultimately fall down group of three, four padded steps. And what we've understood is because she could no longer stand at that point, that that it was a cancer, not anything else, that made that happen. Mm-hmm. And then taken to a hospital. And when you have a combination of cancer and blood in your brain, that's a very bad thing to have. Mm-hmm. And she only woke up after that twice. Once was on a Friday to tell my father that she loves him. I only found out about that on Saturday night because it had already been shipped out over here. Mm-hmm. And then on Sunday, my sister was with her. And she called me and said, Ima's eyes are open. And so she put the phone to her and I said to her, Ima, Eliana and Ami are with me, my children.
Mm-hmm.
And she sat up all of a sudden with enthusiasm and waved to them.
Wow.
And then, incredible. And then lied down again and never opened up her eyes again.
Hmm.
The last thing my mother did was show her love to my children. And that's something that I'm sure they and I will remember forever.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. One of the considerations that many of us have when we move to Israel is leaving parents behind, leaving family behind, because not everybody comes together. Did your mom raise you as a Zionist? Was this something she knew you'd be a part? But is it something that she encouraged that you come to Israel, that you raise a family here, even knowing that the distance would make a difference? Because she was certainly a very loving mother and grandmother. It can't have been easy for her to have been so far away, not just at the end of her life, but during her healthy years. You've been here for quite a while. But did she imbue you with that during your childhood and young adulthood?
Eva, absolutely, of course. I know that I hide it pretty well, and you can't tell from my accent in either language, but both of my parents were raised in Israel. Wow. My mother was born in Jerusalem in January 1948, so she would say that she's Palestinian.
Right, exactly.
She always
before the
she
state.
Always told the story.
Mm-hmm.
She always told the story about how in the War of Independence, a glass shattered over her crib from a window when there was an explosion, and that when she was a baby, and that she was okay because her mother had moved a blanket or a screen over her moments before.
Mm-hmm.
And only about a month before she died did I hear from an aunt that explosion was actually from the terrorist attack that was against the Palestine Post building in downtown Jerusalem.
Wow. So for those of you who don't know, the Palestine Post is the first version of what's now known as the Jerusalem Post. Of course, a Jewish paper, because even before May of 1948, when someone referred to Palestinians, they were referring to Jews. And I hope all of you know that right now, how that has all been completely twisted. So, of course, here's an irony that your mother was saved by a miracle, essentially as a child, from the attack of Arabs against the Palestinian Post. And here you are many, many years later. One of the chief correspondents and really one of the anchors, I would say, to a great degree of that paper. So that's a great story.
That was the first time that the Post tried to prevent me from living.
Mm-hmm.
And
they've been continuing on that vein ever since.
So my parents only came to America initially for a year to study.
Mm-hmm.
My father wanted to bring television to Israel.
Really?
Right after his army service. And then one thing led to another. It was another year, another year, another year. But they always told us that this is where a Jew should live. And I have a sister who made Aliyah at 18, long before I came here, who's very successful in high tech here. And I have two sisters, a doctor and a lawyer in Chicago, who are successful there with families there who I don't expect to move here. And because of that, my mother really always lived on both sides of the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
That was her life. She never left Israel. She lived a very Israeli life in Chicago, and her accent remained. Her Israeli accent was always
there. Mm-hmm. So Israel remained in her heart, even though she wasn't physically here. Where was she buried? You know, there's been a lot of people who Jews who die in the United States want to be buried here in Israel. I would love if Jews lived in Israel, but there are a lot of people who that's their last request is that they be brought to Israel, which it these days is super, super complicated simply because there aren't that many flights coming right now. And there are still people who are managing to do it, but it is definitely not as easy as it used to be. So some people are being buried there, then going to be reinterred. Other people are just being buried there. What was the decision that your family took regarding your mom?
Well, my mother already had a grave here before the coronavirus happened. And so she is in a mausoleum in the Chicago area.
Mm-hmm.
And my father will bring her home here when she can have a
proper funeral.
Proper funeral with all of her loved ones there.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a very, very, very large family, thank God. And so when it happens, there will be thousands of people. And so only when that is possible will she come home.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure all my listeners know how very important the whole death process is when it comes to Jews. If at all possible, we bury as soon as we can. No one leaves the body during the entire time. There's a tremendous respect. It's really called Chesed Shel Emet. It's a true respect, a true kindness, because the person can't pay you back. But there is just, as opposed to our enemies who will even who are very much of a death cult and will desecrate bodies, as happened, let's say, on the Mount of Olives and other Jewish cemeteries around the world, really, until this day. Judaism is very, very different when it comes to respecting the dead person. And so this is not an ideal situation. But given the given what's happening with the pandemic, these are also the halachic dispensations that have been given by the rabbis, because really you try not to reinter, you try not to, you know, disturb the dead in any way. So you sat Shiva. It's actually because your mother passed away on Passover, you really had a 2-week Shiva, because when someone passes away on a festival, you don't start the official mourning period until after the festival is over. So here your mom died early on Passover, and it's not like you weren't mourning. Your mom had passed away, but the official time where people come to visit, or in this case, Zoom into you. So how was that, this kind of postponing the Shiva but starting the mourning? And I'm asking you also, not as a friend, but also as a journalist, because I know that journalists tend to, and I don't know if you do this, see things sometimes in third person. Even while we're experiencing something, we also sometimes step out of ourselves to see it as we would if we were reporting on it. Did you have that, or you were, in this case, like just completely immersed in the first person experience?
That's a fascinating question, even. I don't know how to answer it. Indeed, I did have 2 weeks of Shiva, and that gave me more time to heal, to talk to my family, to be a part of what was going on, to learn the very many laws involved in mourning, and to celebrate my mother's life. And the Zoom, as you mentioned, I zoomed into Shiva, was an incredible experience. Now, I have never sat Shiva normally, using the normal rules, and I hope I don't have to for another 40 years. My father is 75 and in good health, thank God.
Should live and be
But because, as I mentioned, my mother lived in two worlds, with her family here in Israel and with her friends who became like family in Chicago. For her, a Zoom Shiva was actually the right thing, whether there would be COVID or not, because that is what allowed our family to be together. We had wonderful experiences on these Zoom Shivas. I conducted my own, and my sisters in Chicago conducted them. Sometimes they were only for family, sometimes they were more random. But each time I got to hear more and more stories about my mother's life. And so you ask about seeing things through a third person and being a reporter. Well, yeah, I got to ask a lot of questions and learn more. And you know what, Eve? It only made me miss my mother more.
You heard about stories probably that you hadn't heard before and how she affected other people's lives, which I think is the main thing that happens when we lose someone that we love, is we want them to not be forgotten. That we're not going to forget them is clear. But that they affected other people during, in her case, a too short life. and that they have a place for her always in their hearts and in their minds, I would imagine made the pain greater, because the loss is not just your loss and your family's loss. But on the other hand, she will live on for a very long time in other people's lives and the effect that she had on them as well. So the pendulum, it sounds that week, swung very wide for you. And it's interesting that you say that Zoom was actually good, because normally to pay a Shiva call, and for those who are not familiar, Shiva means Sheva. It comes from the word seven. It's the 7 days of mourning, excluding Shabbat, the very intense days that normally you sit in your house. Nobody, you don't do anything for yourself. People come, they bring you meals, they come and visit. And only in this situation now with COVID has it been kind of, you know, zooming in, although people will call you from outside the country, people can't come to visit you. But this way you kind of brought the world into your living room. You physically couldn't have people come and visit. It was really at the peak of the pandemic and people weren't coming at all, but you had more people in there because of this crazy kind of a situation that, I mean, who would have imagined?
Hundreds of people paying tribute via Elle Hoffman as she should be.
Mm-hmm. Now, because of your work, a lot of people know you. I mean, maybe didn't know your mom, but are familiar with you. Virtually every politician, I would imagine, in Israel and more. Were they able to express their condolences and zoom
in? Yes, across the political spectrum. President Rivlin sent me a very nice letter that I read aloud in the Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
Benny Gantz took part in the Shiva. Yuli Edelstein. So two Knesset speakers, really three, that's three Knesset speakers in a row, mm-hmm. right there, which is very special for me as someone who covered the Knesset for 20 years. Gideon Saar, Isaac Herzog, there were really Mirav Michaeli, politicians from across the political spectrum who wrote and called and were a part of it. And Yair Lapid, and made my family feel very special.
With all the noise, and sometimes really it's more than noise, it's nastiness in the Israeli political world, when it comes to life cycle events, let's say, paying a Shiva call, even going to a wedding, I think people would be surprised at how the politics drops away. I remember years ago paying a Shiva call to Yehuda Glick, whose wife had passed away, someone who's very much associated with the Temple Mount and very much on the right, and there were Arab members of Knesset who were there paying a Shiva call when I was there as well, and people who you wouldn't have expected, because beyond all of the, as I said, all of the noise and all of the disagreements, there is still, because I think it's a small world, and you also touch a lot of people on different ends of the spectrum, it's very surprising sometimes how all of that drops away. And when it comes to, maybe it's a Jewish thing, I don't know, but when it comes to really what's important, and family is so important to those of us here in Israel, then, you know, there's no discussion. It just go in and you really, with your real heart, did you feel that anybody was forcing themselves to, because they needed to, because they had, in this case, they didn't have to be seen. This wasn't a popularity contest, because nobody would have known if they zoomed in or not. It was very, very personal and maybe even intimate. And I think it's fantastic that you had so many people from across the board join in and offer you condolences and know what it feels like, you know, to lose a mom, which in this case you're done.
I loved even getting speak to my mother's doctors. They came onto the Shiva. My father told a story in one of the first days of the Shiva about how my mother forced him to go buy orchids, which are very expensive plants. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of COVID, it's very hard to get flowers or anything in America right now, especially for a person over 70 who really should be staying at home.
Mm-hmm.
He did it. He went and he got these seven orchid plants. And my mother went around in a wheelchair in the hospital, distributing them to the doctors who took care of her in mm-hmm. honor of what was supposed to be her second to last radiation treatment mm-hmm. in this round. And she fell down when they were about to leave for the last radiation treatment, which means mm-hmm. her last time that she arrived at the hospital unconscious, she gave very special presents to her doctors. Who wow. does that? I was sitting with my daughter while my father told this story. And she says to me afterward, "How did she know?" And I said to her, "Your grandmother was just an amazing person."
What a beautiful story. And that's something I think that will sit with your daughter for the rest of her life. And perhaps, you know, encourage her to be like that, to think outside of herself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, she is. Thank God. She's learned a lot from her grandmother and definitely gotten her best qualities.
Mm-hmm. And also, I would imagine, and your kids were home during all your Shiva. I mean, usually, you know, in a normal world, sometimes the kids go to school during the day and then come back, and you know, because we sit Shiva for the immediate relatives, the parents, a spouse, siblings, and God forbid, in a gazillion sense, children. But the kids didn't have to sit Shiva for your mom. A grandparent isn't included in that list. But because of what's happening now, your kids were home with you a good part of the time. And I would imagine they got to hear conversations and people saying things about your mom that that might not have heard otherwise.
Eve, my kids were home the entire Shiva, and home means two places for them because their mother lives not far from here. She and others were concerned, oh, they shouldn't be in an environment of grieving or whatever. Maybe they should spend more time at their mother's house. And I had to explain, absolutely not. They're part of the celebration of their grandmother's life over here. And they loved taking part in these Zoom conversations and being a part of it, as did my sister's children. They played a very central role, and it was a very important growth experience for them. And so when they actually were at their other home the last couple of days, they voluntarily and willingly and eagerly joined the Shiva on Zoom from there, which was very special. And I do believe that both parents and children who have been through a divorce can actually handle loss better than others who have not been through a divorce, because we deal with loss all the time. I lose my children every week, and every week that's sad. And they lose a parent every time when they go to the other parent. And obviously it's not permanent, but it's not unnoticed, and it's always going to be emotional, and that will never fully heal.
That's a very interesting perspective that you just gave. Yeah. And your children know that too? I would imagine you're not the kind of dad that holds back when it comes to life lessons to his children. And I think we all have a sense now from describing your mom in the last few minutes about where you got that. But that seems like you really made it deep for them.
Are important. Exactly. Are important for me to convey to them. And in fact, when I was in quarantine for 2 weeks, alone, literally alone, I was in an empty apartment. I made a point of giving my children a lesson every day. I gave them a class, is what we called it, so they would be in proper attention. Somewhere between half an hour and an hour every day, I tried to teach them something that I know about, whether it would be Israeli politics or history and Zionism or Chicago sports. Every day they learned something, and we had guest lecturers, and my children's last extended conversation with my mother, she was the guest lecturer for my class, and she spoke to them for close to an hour about how she met my father in the army and how they fell in love and what it was like being in the army back in those days, the Six-Day War. It was very special that they got to have that. So yes, deep lessons have been conveyed.
Sounds like the ultimate in a substitute teacher when it comes to homeschooling, at least on that level. So are you, You're now after Shloshim. There's now the 30 days. Are you finished with the 30 days? I've completely lost track of time now. No, you're still there because that only started with the
Would
Shiva.
I have a beard?
I don't know. It actually
Would
makes you look
a beard
very
if,
distinguished.
If it were for the 30 days. It's awful. I've got hair growing on my lips and in places that hair should not be.
You should know that most women can totally relate to you now, too.
Yes. Get rid of it. We'll be gone.
So are you allowed to work, though, as much as possible? I mean, here we are in another political maelstrom. Maybe you can explain a little bit to us what's going on, because you're covering the stories and trying to make some sense over what's happening this week in Israel.
Look, there were 2 days left in the Shiva when the government essentially demanded the deal with a, and the rabbis are lenient and working in the last 3 days Shiva. And I keep in mind 14, so wasn't such a bad thing to do. And yes, I did start reporting from the moment that they had reached that level on the night of Holocaust Remembrance Day. And since then, they've been working on translating that deal into government, which is something that takes time. This coming Thursday will be an important day because that's when they're passing the kind of laws necessary to form government, which guarantee trust from one party to another. Only after that will they get to deal with ministerial appointments and whether Yamina will be part of the government on the right. And so there will be an actual period after this Thursday in which Netanyahu officially has the mandate, and then the deadline to form a government would then be 2 weeks from yesterday on the 25th of May. But even then, there's a one-week period where the Knesset speaker can stall. So really, June 1st is the actual deadline for a government to be finalized. And only then will the politicians actually start working full-time on serving the people and no longer serving themselves, which they have been doing for the last year and a half of political mess.
So why is this in court now? That's not the usual thing that happens with forming a government. Well, what is going on when they talk about bagats and all these sessions that are happening in the Supreme Court this week? What's the problem?
Okay, there's three different things. Number one, Netanyahu has 3 criminal indictments hanging over his head, and the Supreme Court has to decide whether a prime minister with indictments can form a government, and the law is not entirely clear, and we've never had such a situation before. The other is that the coalition agreement was written in a shoddy, lackluster, pathetic even kind of way, and it's full of holes and hints and not very much else. And so the judges need to explain to them how to make this document somewhat legal. And the third thing is that there's no trust between Netanyahu and anyone who would work with Netanyahu based on the many, many, many experiences before where he has broken promises to people he made them to. And because of that, the promise that he has made have to be drafted into laws. And it's not entirely clear how these laws can, whether they can in fact be drafted and whether they can be returned. And so this entire process has to be gone through involving the Supreme Court before and after the government's formation before we can really get down to the business of governing.
And as many people feel, myself included, the Supreme Court doesn't seem to be a neutral body. One of the issues that we've had here in Israel, and not just in Israel, but in other countries as well, is that there is a very big power struggle right now between the judiciary, between the court system, and the government. Who is the bottom line? The government that is elected by the people, or the judges who are brought in by themselves. And it seems very clear that the Israeli Supreme Court feels that they are the bottom line, that they are the ultimate arbiter, if you will, and they can supersede Knesset decisions. So given that, where do you think the Supreme Court is going here? If the justices themselves don't like Netanyahu, and the law here, as you said, is very up in the air because there's no precedence for this, do you feel that it's inevitable that their own political leanings are going to impact the decision that they make in court?
Eve, your question came in very choppy, but if I've understood correctly, your question is about the intervention of the Supreme Court at a time when the people of Israel have made a very firm decision that they want to have a unity government led by Netanyahu, that he's drafted a coalition of 78 Knesset members potentially, which is a very large majority, that the polls say that people overwhelmingly still want him in power, and the Likud itself actually got the most votes that any party ever had gotten in history on our election day, March 2nd. And yet, the Supreme Court needs to be there to have a court to oversee our government, because if not, our politicians will do things that are proper. We need to have a media as a watchdog. We need to have courts as a watchdog. We have a prime minister who's gotten away with things that are not legal, both that he's already been cleared of, and both that he's already been made deals to get out of. And so there are things that have not yet been proven that he did, or maybe won't be proven that he did, but there are things that he did. And so we have to be very, very careful. And also, you know, this coal deal was drafted by lawyers who apparently didn't do a very good job, because it's a rather pathetic document. So it needs to be fixed, and it needs to be added to. For instance, there's no guidelines for anything the government will do. Every other government we've had has had clear guidelines on every possible issue. This document says we're going to deal with COVID-19, and in 6 months we'll draw up a new one. And then we'll tell you what our opinion is on actual issues. Hmm. And the judges said, you can't get away with that. And Netanyahu's lawyer said, fine, we'll draft up coalition guidelines before the government is sworn in. Caved in on that immediately in court yesterday, which just shows how flimsy they even knew going into court. They came in not ready.
So you're actually saying that the court is right
guidelines
here.
I cover them. They take weeks to write. Right. They have to go back to the drawing board. They have to start from scratch.
And there's also a chance here that we could still go to new elections. We could have elections again in August.
Technically, yes. And there are people who are serious people who think this will happen. I'm not one of them. But technically, during that 2 week period when Netanyahu has the mandate, he could still decide to try to form a government without Gantz. He made very clear last night that he would not do that. Or he could decide to go to an election. He made very clear last night when he spoke to the people in a press conference that he would not do that. He said a fourth election would be a disaster for Israel, and he knows what he's talking about. It's physically impossible to carry out an election right now, Eve. It's not going to happen.
Right. So this coalition agreement is going to have to be fixed up so that we know what it is we're getting. But it sounds like you're a little wary of what's happening here. Like, a lot of fishy things could happen, and that the court is right to a certain degree to be demanding clearer guidelines. On the other hand, the court has its own reasons, possibly, for not wanting to see Netanyahu as prime minister. So this, the fact that I'm confused, I see, is how a lot of people are feeling, because it sounds like even the lawyers and the people that are right in the thick of it don't have a whole lot of clarity on what's happening.
Yes, we still have to deal with a lot of technicalities before we have a government. Encourage people to be patient. We will eventually have one, and then we'll be out of our political crisis, and we're at the end of the COVID crisis, and hopefully it won't come back. And I think that there are really bright days ahead for Israel, when we'll be out of both of these crises at the same time, and we can work on rebuilding and rejuvenation, right?
Yes, on rejuvenation, exactly. So one more question and then I'll let you go. Are you worried about Israeli democracy? There's been a lot of talk about that, between the fact that we don't have a functioning government, really, that a lot of even, let's say, draconian behaviors were put into play because of COVID, and Israel's not the only country dealing with this, where you have a very large police presence in civilian areas, people getting tickets for doing this and that because of having to keep the pandemic from spreading. But there are some people who will say that some of the authority was overstepped. Are you concerned at all? Do you think Israeli democracy is strong enough to weather both of these storms that we have right now, the health storm and the political storm, or because we also don't have a constitution and some of the things that other countries have, that certain basic laws that keep things in play? Are you concerned at all, or you think that we're going to be just fine because of a strong media and because of a very noisy population that also doesn't take things lying down, at least to a great degree? Are you concerned or not?
Look, because we had to take a government and not an actual functioning government, the prime minister was able to take care of things himself using powers he would not normally have. And if anything, that might have made it actually run better because he's an experienced person who knows how to deal with crises. And we will not always have someone so experienced at the helm of his own crisis. So he knew how to bring on the restrictions gradually to make people accept them. And he did faster than other places did, including America, maybe not as fast as he could have, in part because he didn't want to upset America. And so he did his best, and the people of Israel adapted as best as they could. And then when we have a functioning government, that can do things that a caretaker government could not. For instance, applying sovereignty to the land of Israel, which I know is important to a lot of our listeners here, well, that could not have been done without a fully functioning government. And Trump kept on delaying the release of his plan. Then he announced it to help Netanyahu's campaign when he did, but it couldn't be implemented yet. Well, this plan, even according to the short coalition guidelines that there were, is due to be implemented already from the 1st of July, which is coming up quickly.
Yes.
This is a government that can implement it. And this is a president of the United States who can implement it. And you never know what the next government of Israel is going to be. And you never know who the next president of the United States is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So that period between when we finally have a government, which could be as late as the 1st of June, and when America has Trump as president, which could be only until January, you never know, could be a very fateful time, future of the state of Israel, the land of Israel, and the people of Israel.
Wow. All right. It's going to be a hot summer. Either way we cut it. All right. Gil Hoffman, thanks so much for joining me today. Looking forward to you having your own podcast back here when things settle down for you. And thanks really for sharing the memories of your mom, the unusual circumstances that have accompanied you in the last few weeks, but the fact that you are still so devoted to what you do and to being a correspondent and to really making sure that things are clear for your readers in a very, very complicated situation. And I think that when one doesn't have to listen between the lines to the last few minutes of speaking to you, to understand that you're not swayed one way or the other. You're very clear on the facts. You made it very clear that Netanyahu, as a leader, did an excellent job here when it came to the pandemic because he deals with crises and he knows how to get things done. But on the other hand, you're not letting him off the hook when it comes to maybe crimes that he did or certainly things that need to be put on the table and dealt with. He can't get away with that. Being an excellent leader doesn't let you have free rein, perhaps, to doing things that leaders should not do. And I think that voice that you have is a very, very important voice that we need here in the country. And I, for one, am very glad that you're out there and doing what you need to do. So be well. Really be well. When people say that these days, it's not just a throwaway. To thank all my listeners, I want to apologize for the not great audio quality that I have here and for the delays. Because of COVID-19, I have not been able to get a cable that I needed for my computer, and therefore my interviews are not at the level that I would like them to be, but hopefully that will be taken care of in the near future. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. You can write to me, eve@thelandofisrael.com, with many thanks always to Ben and to Tabitha, who are really there no matter what time of day to get our shows out, and very much appreciative of that, especially Tabitha's got kids in her house, so it's not always so simple to get everything done, but they're there all the time. So take care, everyone, and all of you be well, and God willing, I will be back next week. So that's it. Goodbye for now.